Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us for the first half of the show today is Dr. Joseph Rahm. He's the author of Climate Change, What Everyone Needs to Know. He's also the former acting assistant secretary for energy efficiency and renewable energy in the U.S. Department of Energy. Joe, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So let's start with this. What brought you to the topic of climate science and to have such a focus on climate communication?
Well, I was, for a very long time, as you mentioned, working in the clean energy arena. I was at the Department of Energy for 5 years and ended up running the billion-dollar Office of Efficiency and Renewables in 1997. And I was continuing for many years to advise companies on how they could reduce greenhouse gas emissions using energy efficiency, better lighting, heating, cooling, and solar and wind. And then my brother lost his home in Hurricane Katrina, August 29th, 2005. He lived in Pass Christian, Mississippi, which had a 20-foot storm surge, and he was in a shelter, but the home was just, you know, turned into like a what he described as a washing machine, and so he actually asked me if he should rebuild his home, and I had, because he knew I had studied at the Scripps Institution of Oceanography while I was getting my physics PhD, and so I started talking to climate scientists and going to seminars and reading the science myself, and I learned two things. One was that the climate situation was more dire than I thought, and second, the climate scientists were not doing a good job of communicating it. And since I, was raised by writers and had done a lot of writing, I stopped doing clean energy consulting basically then and started writing full-time. I wrote a book called Hell and High Water, and then I started blogging in 2006, 12 years ago, for the Center for American Progress Action Fund, and been blogging ever since, and, just have written thousands of stories, and you get a lot of feedback online as to what, people read or what they don't read. What do they put on Facebook? What do they retweet? So, I learned how to explain things better, and hopefully, and that got me interested in understanding. How do you communicate this to this new online audience?
I read that your daughter was also an important critic of yours.
Well, my daughter, yes. It's funny. My daughter Antonia was. When you have a child, you realize that the way you were taught to communicate doesn't really work, and that you actually go back to the way everyone used to communicate, which is telling stories. And I, as I studied this, I, realized more and more that what's the way scientists were communicating was using facts and charts and numbers. And while that works very well in an academic setting, it's just not the way the vast majority of people communicate. It's not how people actually process information or make decisions. And so I've read, a great deal of the literature on how how communication occurs and how what makes people remember things. So that has influenced me. So I hope, in this book. So Oxford University Press asked me, they have this series, What Everyone Needs to Know, and they asked me to write the climate book. The nice thing about this book, you have it, then you've seen, it's written, it's like 100 question and answers.
Right.
So you can sit down and, just look through the table of contents and see, oh, I'm interested in learning about electric cars, or I'm interested in learning about sea level rise, or I want to know what the Paris Climate Treaty was. And then you can just read, a couple pages on that. And it tried to reduce it into manageable bites. it's, you know, it got a very good response, and New York Magazine said it was the best single source primer on the state of climate change. So, you know, I've it's written for a general audience. It's not a political book.
Right.
It basically just lays out the facts for a general educated audience, but it doesn't assume that you have any prior science or physics or knowledge on climate.
I have to say that the organization of questions and the questions that were selected were excellent. It starts with the very first section of the book is the climate science basics. So if you just need that basic understanding of how does this work, why is it happening, that's there. You wrap that section up by asking the question, have we already crossed tipping points or points of no return in the climate system? So tell us about that.
Yeah, well, this is certainly one of the major... So the question is there a point after which certain of the consequences can't be prevented? And the answer, according to science, is yes. If, as I tell people, if you put an ice cube in the middle of your room on your table, it's going to start... if the temperature's, above freezing and the higher above freezing, it's going to start melting. You know, and once it started melting, if you were to say, well, how am I going to stop it from melting? Well, you can't just you have to really lower the temperature, right? You can't just stop increasing the temperature. You have to actually lower the temperature. So if you look at the great ice sheets in particular, Greenland and the Antarctic ice sheets, they have started to melt, and it's a combination of warm air temperatures and warm ocean currents. So it's melting from on top, and it's melting from beneath. And there is a big question. Is the Earth's oceans and air sufficiently warm that if we didn't warm anymore, the collapse significant destruction, significant disintegration of the ice sheets would occur and significant sea level rise would occur? And I think most scientists would tell you we're pretty close. We are pretty close to levels of carbon pollution in the atmosphere and temperatures where the Earth in the past at those temperature levels didn't have very much ice on Greenland and didn't have very much ice in the West Antarctic ice sheet, and those two combined are potentially 40 feet of sea level rise. Now, you know, the good news is the seas don't rise 40 feet, you know, in years or even a few decades. That's a slow process, melting of a massive ice sheet. But the point is, at a certain amount of pollution in the air and a certain amount of temperature, it's going to be almost impossible to stop that.
Okay.
And so what we're doing is, you know, we're close to the point where it's going to be hard to stop, let's say, 4 or 5 feet of sea level rise by the end of this century, and a foot of sea level rise by mid-century, and it just keeps going and going. So, you know, what makes climate change such a difficult issue for people to deal with is that right now the change is worrisome, but it's not devastating.
Hmm.
But the change has been speeding up, and we know, I mean, the scientists 20 years ago, they said if you keep putting all, you know, burning fossil fuels, putting carbon pollution to the air, you're going to warm up the planet and you're going to see, you know, more extreme weather, you're going to see warmer temperatures, more heat waves, more droughts, and sea levels will rise, and we're seeing that now. But the point is, they're now saying, if you keep doing this, then over the next few decades, it's going to get worse and worse. So you better stop now because, you know, like someone who's smoking and has a cough, you know, you can stop and things won't get worse.
Right.
But if you don't, then the doctor can tell you, yeah, this is what is very likely to happen to you. Yeah. So, you know, that's where we are. We really have don't have a lot of time to avoid some of the worst impacts. And now the good news is, and I, you know, about a third of the book is devoted to talking about the clean energy revolution and the fact that we now have the technologies available to replace most of the fossil fuel infrastructure, but we have to act faster than we are acting now.
So you've been involved in climate science since the mid-late 90s when the IPCC reports first came out.
Yep.
How has the trends identified by the early IPCC reports unfolded? Are they spot on, or are we accelerating at it? Is the rate of warming increasing at a greater rate than even the early IPCC reports suggested?
Well, you know, we've had as of now, right now, we're at about the rate of temperature rise the IPCC projected. We're sort of near the IPCC projects a range based on emissions, and we're kind of in the middle of that. Clearly, the last few years have seen rapid warming, mm-hmm. and the five hottest years on record. You know, this is a 140-year temperature record. They have all occurred since this decade, the decade of the 2010s. And so I think if you were to talk to most climate scientists, and I try to, you know, for this book and then for this new edition, I have tried to review the science and talk to people. I think they would say the predictions on the temperature have been pretty accurate. There are some things that have happened faster than people thought. The melting of ice has happened faster. Whether we're talking sea ice in the Arctic or the landlocked ice, it's the landlocked ice that raises sea levels.
Right.
But the other thing that I think has surprised scientists is this. You know, the rate of increase of off-the-charts weather events. And as scientists have studied this, they've come to understand some of the reasons behind that, and I try to explain that in the book. But the main point for people to realize is that when you increase the temperature, let's say 2 degrees Fahrenheit, which is roughly where we're at, that may not seem like a lot. Because obviously, you know, many people live in places that are 2 degrees warmer or 2 degrees colder than wherever you are right now. But what you're doing is, if you can visualize a bell curve, is you're shifting the entire bell curve. And at the tail end of the bell curve, that's where the extreme events occur. And when you move that rapidly diminishing tail 2 degrees Fahrenheit to the right, you are creating a dramatic increase in the most extreme events,
right.
The ones that are, you know, called several standard deviations from the norm. And so, you know, you might say something that was a once-in-a-thousand-year event, like a Superstorm Sandy.
Or Ellicott City.
Or Ellicott City, right. So you see, and where's your audience?
Well, we're out here in Park City, Utah.
Okay. Oh yeah, well I'm here near. I think on this, you know, wet places are going to see more extreme wet events. So Hurricane Hart, well, you know, what happened to Houston? That was actually over much of the Houston area a once in a 25,000 year event, but it's only once in 25,000 years in the old climate. In the new climate, where hurricanes can form rapidly and weather systems can stall because the jet stream is weaker, you can have a storm spin up and sit over your city for 4 days, and you can get more rainfall than the continental United States has ever seen in a 5-day period. You know, now in Utah, you know, it's a different matter. If the science predicts that wet areas will get wetter, because when you heat up the ocean, the wet areas tend to be near the oceans and large bodies of water. When you heat up those bodies of water, more water evaporates, and therefore there's more water in the atmosphere available to come down. The dry areas, however, like the desert southwest, they get drier. And that's because when you heat up some place that's relatively dry, you evaporate, you know, you dry out the land, you dry out the reservoirs, and the whole place becomes more arid. And obviously, you know, California just went through, you know, and, you know, the worst drought it's seen in 1,400 years. And the, you know, the whole Southwest has clearly entered in the last two decades into a drier state, a hotter and drier state. And it doesn't mean every year is going to be record-setting. It just means, on average, you're going to get hotter and drier years, and therefore the odds of a string of five, you know, hot and dry years has gone up dramatically, and clearly that has happened, you know, in your part of the country.
Right.
If you are just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Joseph Rahm. He is the author of Climate Change, What Everyone Needs to Know. Joe, I want to take a few minutes to talk about a topic related to climate change that you've included in your book that I have, Chris and I have never encountered in a conversation of climate change before. This is actually a question that I have asked before and kind of been waved off.
Brushed aside,
I would say. And this has to do with the human health impacts of climate change and the amount of CO2 in the atmosphere. So tell us, it sounds like the research here is in the early stages, but tell us what people are finding.
Yeah, well, for most of human evolution, the amount of CO2 in the air that we breathe for hundreds of thousands of years was in a pretty narrow range between, you know, 200 to 280, that sort of range. It didn't change very much. In the last century, of course, we've dramatically increased the CO2 level in the air to over 400. In fact, we're over 410 parts per million. And so that's the baseline outdoor rate. That's the baseline for everyone's CO2 levels. But, of course, in the last century, we've also moved staggering amounts of people into buildings that are fairly sealed. So we now have large numbers of people in spaces where CO2 levels are higher because, you know, humans exhale CO2. So CO2 levels indoors are routinely 800 parts per million, 1,000 parts per million, and in places with bad ventilation or where you cram in a lot of people, like if you go to one of a big meeting of your entire organization where dozens of people are in a small room and they're there all day, and the room's ventilation wasn't designed for it, then the CO2 levels can hit, you know, 1,500 parts per million, 2,000 parts per million. And no one has really studied what the impact of those CO2 levels are on human cognition, thinking, until recently. And multiple studies are now showing that as you start to notice that the air in the room is getting stuffy.
Yes.
And you may be feeling a little, you know, sluggish as a result, or your meeting after a few hours suddenly you like gets really boring. A lot of that is simply because as the CO2 level goes up, human cognition does decline.
Right.
Measurably and I've talked to a lot of people about this. I talked to the chief flight surgeon for the U.S. Space Station, which because they are in outer space and they don't have oxygen, they have to, they don't have an atmosphere to get oxygen from. They have to bring their own, and CO2 levels tend to be quite high, and they keep track assiduously of the astronauts' health and symptoms. And they noticed that as you increase the CO2 levels that you expose astronauts to, their reported headaches go up sharply.
Right.
And obviously it worries them a great deal because you want to have great, you want to have your astronauts to have very good mental decision making at all times because you never know when that, you know, sudden problem is going to emerge.
Right. And again, we're talking relatively, compared to concentrations of oxygen, which is typically 19%, so that's 19,000 parts per million.
Yeah.
Just small changes in carbon dioxide, like you talk about, from, say, 3 to 4 to 5, 6, 700 parts per million, that has an influence. That has an impact relative to these high concentrations, relatively high concentrations of oxygen and nitrogen in our atmosphere. So you're saying small changes from 300, 400 parts per million to 500, 600, 700 parts per million can have effect on human cognition.
Yes, absolutely, and it's being studied more. Your body, as you may know, there's a condition called acidosis where your blood is more acid, and your body has developed, tries very hard to regulate CO2 levels because CO2 acidifies, your soda can, carbonated
right.
water is slightly acidic. And so your body is trying to avoid letting your body's acidity go up, and as a result, what appears to be happening is that as CO2 levels rise, your body is respiration is trying to deal with the higher CO2 levels, and that starts to have this measurable impact. But yes, and I as a father, it's of concern because the places in this country and around the world, one of the places that has the highest CO2 levels is where you put a bunch of high respirating people in a space with bad ventilation all day long, otherwise known as our schools. Mm-hmm. And CO2 levels in schools have been routinely monitored. Something like a third of Texas schools have CO2 levels above 1,500 parts per million.
Wow.
So, and there is evidence linking the CO2 levels in a building to test scores. So I think science is relatively new. Because no one thought to examine it. But Lawrence Berkeley National Lab did a major study, and the Harvard School of Public Health did a large study. I spoke to the authors of both of those. So I think that the green building community, which I know very well, has been working to deal with this, to improve ventilation and
right.
and generally. But yes, I think that this is one of those emerging issues that is going to be of more and more concern to people.
And I want to correct myself. I said that oxygen levels average 19% in the atmosphere. That's true. That's not 19,000 parts per million. It's 190,000 parts per million.
It is 190,000 parts
that's,
per million.
And it's an even bigger difference between the two, but still have big impacts. We only have a couple of minutes. Nell, you had one more question or so.
Well, yeah, in the last couple of minutes, we wanted to talk about the last question that you included here in the book. Do we still have time to preserve a livable climate with a U.S. president who rejects climate science? Where do you stand on that?
Yeah.
Well, that's the central question, and this is where the intersection of science and economics and politics come in. You know, we haven't crossed this tipping point yet. We're very close, but whether we cross them or not is going to depend on a lot of international political will. And of course, what made me optimistic was that in December 2015, all of the nations of the world, some 200 came together in Paris and unanimously agreed to ratchet down their carbon pollution over time and to keep total warming, below 2 degrees Celsius, which is 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit. And they all came forward with plans to start doing that. And even China did, and every country did. It was quite amazing. And because the U.S., in fact, made a partnership under Obama, made a deal with China, we were able to get commitments from China that no one expected, and those, because the two biggest emitters made the deal, other countries came along. And so we got that Paris deal, and lots of money has been going into renewables, and lots of countries have been taking action to reduce deforestation, to embrace clean energy, to reduce fossil fuels, to embrace electric cars. And then, of course, we elect Donald Trump, and he's been campaigning, you know, he campaigned on claims that, you know, the science was a hoax and that global warming wasn't real, and somehow this deal, international deal, was bad for the U.S., when in fact, you know, it's a really great deal for the U.S. because, right, for reasons I explain in the book. And so, that was like 1 year ago, June 1st of last year. So we're talking about, you know, we just passed the one-year anniversary of this decision, which really made us a rogue nation. It lost us a lot of support among countries around the world, who many countries, of course, are suffering from the impacts of climate change, but they're not big contributors.
Right.
We suffer from the impacts, and we're also a very big contributor. And needless to say, doesn't other countries look at us and think, well, you're the richest country in the world, and you're a big contributor. Why aren't you doing anything? So the 2018 election and 2020 election are simply going to be very important in whether we can get people back running the U.S. government who understand both the science is real and of concern, but B, you know, the solutions are there, and we don't need to be trying to bring back the fossil fuels of, you know, the energy systems of the 19th century, as the Trump administration is now discussing. We, you know, the rapidly growing clean technologies, that's where the future is. That's where the future jobs are. That's why China and Europe are betting heavily on them. And we invented some of those technologies, and it would be a great shame if we, you know, let the leadership in those technologies come to other countries.
Well, Joseph Rahm, unfortunately, it's time for us to wrap up this segment of the show. Thank you so much for joining us today. I cannot say enough wonderful things about this book as a resource for climate change.
Terrific.
Thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, thank you so much for taking the time to join us this morning on This Green Earth.
That's Joseph Rahm, the author of Climate Change, What Everyone Needs to Know.
And let's take a break for a couple of underwriters and sponsors. And when we come back, we'll actually turn towards some talk about solutions, one of them being electric cars and what role that can play in reducing our CO2 concentrations in the atmosphere. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
This is Brooks Arbertson, commercial lender for Mountain West Bank, sponsor of the amazing programming on KPCW. At Mountain West Bank, we offer consumer loan options as well as home loans and business loans in one location. Mountain West Bank, just off Kearns, next to the theaters. MountainWestBank.com, division of Glacier Bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender.
Hi, this is Steve Roney, owner of Berkshire Hathaway Home Services, Utah Properties. I'm a proud resident of Park City and a loyal supporter of KPCW and all it does for our community. Our agents in Summit and Wasatch counties can be reached at any of our 30 offices or at our website, bhhsutah.com.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. I'm Nell Larson.
And I'm Chris Cherniak.
And joining us in the studio now for the second half of the show is Micah Kagan. And he is with the locally based nonprofit Leaders for Clean Air. And he's joining us to introduce their organization this morning. Micah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, why don't you start by telling us about how Leaders for Clean Air got started? What was the motivation?
Sure. So Leaders for Clean Air has been around in one form or another for the last, you know, 3-4 years. Originally, it was founded as sort of a business-to-business network of business leaders who were concerned about our air quality, thought encouraging, you know, people to install charging stations was, you know, a good thing to do. So kind of we're starting through their own business networks. that kind of led into the phase that we're in now, where we actually work with Rocky Mountain Power and UCARE. They provide us with, you know, some grant money and some contracts to help promote public charging infrastructure in Utah. And it's been great. You know, we've seen tremendous adoption and success, you know, with the companies that we've worked with the public sector that's stepping forward. And it's great to see, because we, you know, electric cars are coming, and to lay the infrastructure today is a really smart thing that we can do.
What is the motivation of the companies that come to you or approach you asking for these stations?
Sure. So a lot of them view it as, I would say, you know, a benefit to their employees. You know, employers will offer a gym pass or a transit pass or, you know, something else. It's an entitlement to, hey, come work for us. Mm-hmm. We're a cool company. Charging is something else they can offer. You know, it has a public benefit. You know, the more people that drive electric cars, the cleaner our air can be. So the employer says, hey, look, I'm going to make, you know, a statement here and say, you know, I'm going to install charging stations. We think this is a great thing to do for clean air, and we're offering it as a benefit to our employees. So that's, you know, that's one thing that they look at.
So it's like, hey, free fuel.
In a way,
yes. It's like, come work for us. Maybe this back in the 70s or 80s, and we'll fill up your tank every day.
Well, and the interesting thing is, if you look at the cost, right, what is the cost of the electricity dispensed? And you're talking pennies on the dollar versus what it takes to fill your car up. So it's not like someone pulls up and says, hey, my tank costs $50. It's like, well, if you want the equivalent, here's $1. Right. And that's the electricity that we, that, you know, we've provided as a benefit. You know, companies don't charge you to charge your cell phone at work. They don't charge you for the paper towels you use in the restroom. Those are benefits. So again, you know, we're just going to provide a little electricity for this public benefit.
And who were the early adopters with this? Which companies jumped on board soon, and how has that grown?
So the founding board member of our organization, Honko Kiesner, he's the CEO of this company, PackSize. PackSize has the largest workplace charging installation in the state. They have about 50 Level 2 electric vehicle chargers, along with 2 DC fast chargers.
And explain, let's take a little aside there and explain what those are.
No, that's a good point. Thank you. So a Level 2 charger is great for public use. It, you know, will fully charge a car, you know, 4 to 6 hours, but that's not really what it's used for. If you think about how you drive and what your patterns are, you're going to be charging at home, right? You know, when your car is idle from 6 to 6 at night, it doesn't move. So when you leave your garage, you're going to be full. The average American drives about 35 miles a day. Utah's a little bit higher, about 39, 40. But think about that. That's 20 miles each way to work. You're not getting to work completely empty. You don't need a super fast charge to get you back to where you want to be to give you the confidence you're going to get home. So Level 2 charging is great for the workplace. It's a little bit lower. It doesn't pull a ton of power, but still, you know, gets your car charged full because you're not coming in completely empty. That's Level 2. Level 3 is the fast charger. That's what enables you to drive long distances on the highways. Mm-hmm. It's great for fleet vehicles. You know, if you're a company, you have, let's say, a delivery van and it's just running laps. Mm. It doesn't want to have a long dwell time. Maybe it has only 30 minutes, but this can zap it up. And now you have an electric delivery van riding around. So That's sort of the charging basics.
Perfect.
So yes, so PackSize is a great example. They have about 50 electric vehicle chargers. There are now about 33 dedicated electric vehicle drivers. They have fast chargers to enable a delivery van. They have a fast charger for the public. They've been great partners. Snowbird has been a great partner. They've installed chargers. All the ski resorts really have really gotten behind this because they want to encourage people to, you know, drive electric, you know, to the resort. And, you know, again, providing that charging is a benefit, you know. Maybe it, you know, affects the decision I make, you know, where I want to go today because there's charging available.
Right. Well, I was just thinking where I would want to shop. If I want to go to a market, mm-hmm. all things being equal, I will have a tendency to want to gravitate towards that market that has a charger.
Exactly.
And hope that it'll be available.
Right.
You know, because that there's supply and demand in play too. But that's an influence.
Absolutely. And I think, again, we have an issue here in the Wasatch Front, and that issue is air quality. I think we all kind of recognize that. And one of the things that we can do as a community, you know, to view charging in a way as a public good, to say the externalities of this, the externalities of encouraging people to drive electric vehicles. So, you know, these pollutants in our airshed, you know, will go away over time as more people drive electric cars. And I think if we view it from that way, and it's really low cost, it is a really low cost thing to do. We can all get behind this and encourage this really nascent industry because of the benefits that it'll provide.
So I'm curious if the companies that have invested in a big way in this are seeing the like car purchasing decisions of their employees change. Are people now opting for electric or hybrid vehicles?
Absolutely. And another company that I could point to is Zag. They're down in Midvale. They manufacture cell phone accessories and stuff like that.
Okay.
They initially started with a handful, 4 to 6 stations, I think it was, and have since expanded to 16. They did a really smart thing. They sort of planned for this growth and just kind of had, you know, the infrastructure ready to go because they kind of thought this was going to happen, and boom, it did. And you can chart the growth of drivers as demand grew. They just kept on adding more stations. And again, it was a really low cost thing for them to do to provide this benefit to their employees that employees seem really happy with.
So we're talking about businesses, kind of point to point or round trip types of conditions and situations. Are you working on general infrastructure to talk about, say, fast chargers along at rest stops or truck stops or fast food restaurants
and
along the interstate?
Yeah, and you know, Rocky Mountain Power is really stepping up and taking a lot of this burden on. You know, they're doing a lot of work with public charging infrastructure. They were instrumental in getting the fast charger at Kimball Junction. So now, and this, it's a really good thing that they're doing, is they're trying to encourage rideshare drivers to drive electric cars. So they've thought very strategically about where can we put these pieces of public infrastructure that would have, you know, the most benefit. So now they're by the airport. They're in downtown Salt Lake City. They're in Kimball Junction. So not only rideshare drivers, but the public as well can view this infrastructure, you know, linking our highways to enable this long distance travel. They're doing the same thing up and down I-15 with Maverick. Maverick's another interesting case, traditionally a gasoline company, but they view this as providing fuel to customers. And
sure.
I think, you know, that concept of fuel, they're a fueling company, let's provide the fuel. So they're
now
working.
Are locations like Maverick, are they charging for a fast charge as they would for gasoline?
Yeah, some are, some aren't.
Okay.
Maverick, yes, there is a slight fee associated with it. But again, if you're looking at, you know, apples to apples comparison, it's still way cheaper than having to fill up a gas tank. Others like Salt Lake City are viewing this as a public good and charging is free. So it really is up to the, you know, you can say the motive of the company. Or the goals they're trying to achieve, I actually think is a better way to phrase that. You know, there probably is a case to be made, you know, at some point down the line that, yes, we should charge for this because if you provide a good and, you know, under its price, people are going to tend to overconsume it. So pricing does have a mechanism. But given the sort of, you know, sort of infancy that this pushes in some aspects, it's better just to say, hey, we're going to provide this for free.
Sure. And how is that infrastructure? You know, if I were driving an electric vehicle, can I make the trip down to St. George without worrying about recharging? How does that infrastructure look throughout the state?
Yeah, so that's what, you know, Maverick, Rocky Mountain Power are doing up and down I-15. The ultimate goal is to have fast charger available, I believe, about every 50 miles.
Okay.
They're working on building it out. I don't exactly know what the numbers are today, but I do know there are a handful of stations that are already, you know, operating on I-15. And yes, it can be done, and it's happening. And you know, the crazy thing about this is, you know, like any technology, you know, charging is developing so fast that the chargers that we're putting in today, you know, that, you know, maybe would take a 30-minute stop, 5-10 years down the road, that number comes down. And you know, sooner or later, you're at 5 minutes, which is the perfect time to stop, bathroom break,
right?
You know, and then get on your way. And charging becomes second nature, you know, just like when you plug your cell phone in at night or when you fill up your car. That's a, you know, that was a behavior that we all learned because that's how you filled up your car. But if you just sort of say, okay, well, I don't go to the gas station. I plug my car in here and I plug my car there. It becomes a habit, and That's all it is.
We're speaking with Micah Kagan. He's with Leaders for Clean Air. It's a 501c3 nonprofit committed to implementing large-scale electric charger projects, among other things. And is there talk, too, about maybe at least supplementing some of this fuel source with solar panels in locations around the state that might be good locations, the southern part of the state too?
Yeah, you know, I know Rocky Mountain Power is diversifying their portfolio. You know, I know they are branching out into solar. I know they're getting like wind power from Wyoming. So the point I think, you know, that is related to that is as the infrastructure becomes cleaner,
yeah,
electric cars also become greener. A car that already does not emit, you know, already gets even cleaner because, you know, we are eliminating, you know,
the point source at the coal-fired power plant.
Correct. So right. Just as the grid diversifies, becomes a little cleaner again, right, everything throughout the life cycle of the grid, including electric vehicles.
Right.
But, you know, the important thing to understand, though, I think, about electric cars is those are the things that we can see on our roads every single day. You know, we have our built environment, and there are probably other things that we can do to encourage less trips in your car. But the built environment being what it is, we drive our cars. And as a community, as, you know, a state, we can all do this. And, you know, the next time your car comes up, drive that electric car because it's a really fun experience if you've never driven one. Even, you know, it's not just the higher end cars that are out there. There are consumer grade cars and they're really fun to drive.
And I wanted to go back real quick about you mentioned rideshare services that may be adopting electric cars, and because perhaps their clients, their customers might prefer that.
Exactly.
And maybe even pay up a little premium to ride, you know, to drive, to be transported in an electric car. So you're seeing trends there.
No, absolutely. I mean, I think Lyft already does this, right? They provide carbon offsets, I think, for every ride that they give. And so, yes, there is a consumer out there that will make this choice that says, you know, if it's a $1, $2 difference in fare, sure, I'll ride that electric car. That sounds like fun.
Well,
community good.
Exactly.
Okay. Yeah.
Go ahead.
Well, if companies around here are interested in getting involved or installing these chargers, where do they start?
Sure. Start with our website, leadersforcleanair.org. Just get in touch with us and we can help you. You know, Rocky Mountain Power is offering 75% rebates on the chargers. So they're really stimulating the market for this. You know, lots of companies have taken advantage of this benefit. So we'd love to talk to you. We'll come out. We'll assess your site. We will help you plan this project, make it successful, because that's really, you know, our goal is to make sure these projects come off well. And, you know, we've done this up and down the Wasatch Front, and we'd be happy to help anybody.
Is there an app or a place I can go to see where all the chargers are?
Yeah, if you go to PlugShare.
PlugShare.
You can download the app. You can check it out. You know, a lot of electric vehicles also have the onboard software. You know, so when you're driving them, you know, like, pretty much any car does today, I'll say, you know, you're running low. Here's, you know, the closest fueling stations, and same thing for chargers.
Oh, okay. All right. And is there a way to know that charging space is occupied or unoccupied?
Ooh,
yes. So there are some networks that do have that functionality to let you know, and sort of help manage that. But, you know, one of the things that we're trying to do is when charging becomes ubiquitous, when charging becomes everywhere, you don't run into that. You don't run into the issue, oh man, this stall is taken.
The one stall.
Right. So part of, again, what we're trying to do, build this public infrastructure. It's extremely low cost. I cannot emphasize that enough, that the incentives in place, you know, to take advantage of this are really strong. You know, but to put in enough infrastructure to say, charging's here. And you will see incredible adoption if you do that.
Are you seeing this happening in other states too?
Yeah, you know, different states have taken different approaches. You know, California has taken an aggressive approach. You know, there are some, you know, stories to be told, you know, about how incentives in the public marketplace do affect this market, not specifically as it relates to chargers, but the state of Georgia. They had an electric vehicle incentive. I think it was $3,500, $5,000, somewhere in that range. Extremely successful. They did away with it, and the market for electric vehicles you know, was cut in half, 90%
right.
you know, decline in electric vehicle sales. So it does show what the roles that public policy can play in this debate. And, you know, as a state with an issue that we all deeply care about, the air quality in the Wasatch Front, it's really what it all comes back to for me. You know, the whole reason to do this is we talk about it, you know, all the time. Our state, this natural beauty, you know, why we all love living here. And there's a real direct thing that we all can do to, you know, be a part of preserving what we have. And I feel very fortunate to be able to build this infrastructure out, to know that we're laying the groundwork for what is coming down the road. I can't wait for that day to get here.
All right.
Fantastic.
Again, your website?
Leadersforcleanair.org.
Leadersforcleanair.org. Micah Kagan, representative. What is your role with? I'm sorry, what is your title with them?
The Director of Business Development.
Director of Business. Yeah. Okay, perfect. Well, you're the perfect person to have on here then. Great job.
Great.
And thank you so much for taking the time
to
join
us.
And we'll stay in touch to see how these trends evolve.
Please.
This is an ongoing story. Thanks again. Let's take a quick break for a couple of underwriters. When we come back, got a news item or two and calendar event stuff.
Yeah.
In a few minutes. It's This Green Earth. We'll be right back.
Matt here from San Francisco Design. Since the start of our business in 1990, we have been supporting KPCW. We offer home decor for Park City and Salt Lake and feature modern furnishings from around the world. Whether you're looking to furnish an entire home or just redecorating a single room, we can help with our in-house design team. Located on Bonanza Drive and on the web at sanfrandesign.com.
Additional funding for programming on KPCW has been provided in part by Long Reimer Weiniger Bepler, Estate Planning, Family Law, LRW-Law.com, Fred Marshall Painting, painting Park City's homes since 1974, FredMarshallPainting.com, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and listeners like you.
Welcome back to This Green Earth. We got... Well, we only have a few minutes.
Yeah.
So let's save that news story about the River of Warblers.
Okay.
For another week.
All
it's
right.
really interesting because actually there's climate change related.
We don't want to have to rush through the no, warblers.
It deserves some time because they're warblers.
and we all deserve love them.
Yeah, we do. So, but let's touch on a couple of local events that are going on.
Well, I have
Are they warbler-related, perhaps?
This event is not warbler-related, and this is an event at Swanner Preserve and Eco Center, but I have to mention this because I know you love monarchs, Chris.
Yeah, all butterflies.
This Thursday,
not monarch bias.
June 7th at 7 o'clock, we're hosting an event called Saving the Monarchy, One Milkweed at a Time.
Oh.
And this is an event about monarchs, about monitoring them in Utah, kind of about their status. The state rare plants biologist is kind of now leading up an effort to gather data. So there's opportunities for citizen scientists to get involved and help with that. And you'll also learn how to grow milkweed, which is the one plant upon which
That's it.
Monarchs are dependent. And every attendee
Can't they?
Will go home with their own milkweed
Okay,
plants.
Great. And milkweed is not an invasive species?
Correct. There are native milkweeds
Perfect.
To this area, which is something we definitely double-checked.
And I can plant and
this.
Grow them.
Mm-hmm.
They don't require any special care or so. I mean,
right.
I'm sure there's
some
care.
To get it established, you're going to need to give it a little bit of care. But at this event, you'll learn exactly what that is. You'll also learn how to propagate your own with the seed. So if you want to grow that garden in future year to attract monarchs.
Do I get a butterfly with that?
Well,
too?
You are
attached
not.
To
you
it?
Are not provided with a butterfly.
That's my goal.
Next year, we'll think about that.
Okay. So that's, when is that again?
So that's this Thursday at 7 p.m. You do need to register online. Just go to swannerecocenter.org or to Eventbrite to sign up for that. It is $5 for members and $10 for
So
members.
I could tear up my Kentucky bluegrass and replace it with milkweed.
Yeah. How cool would that be?
Oh, my God. All right.
Yeah. A little wildflower.
And maybe nurseries
garden.
Will start selling milkweed or something like that?
You know, we absolutely hope so because we've gotten so much interest in this event and in monarchs. I think people know that they're kind of a threatened species right now. And so people are interested in doing what they can to help in their own yard.
And so monarchs are native to this area too, in a sense. Mm-hmm. They're either passing through.
Yeah, the area, there are several different kind of complex migration routes for monarchs, but they do pass. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So we're not trying to introduce a new exotic species here.
Yeah, that's a good point. Yeah.
Okay. So that's this Thursday at 7.
Yeah, this Thursday at 7. That's sign up online.
Go online and learn more about it. Okay.
Absolutely.
All right. Let's
wrap up.
Yeah. we got less than a couple minutes. Let's first thank our guest, Dr. Joe Rahm, author of the book Climate Change: What Everyone Needs to Know.
An amazing book. I have to say I enjoyed reading.
How many questions and answers are in there, you think?
Oh, gosh. I don't know. 100 plus.
At least 100.
Yeah.
Okay. Because there's at least 100 things you need to know about climate change. All right.
Yep. And then, of course, we want to thank Micah Kagan from Leaders for Clean Air for talking about their free electric vehicle charging station installation. And then we want to thank our underwriters who make this show possible. They include Recycle Utah,
Republic Services,
Southern Utah Wilderness Alliance,
Vail Epic Promise,
Berkshire Hathaway Home Services Utah Properties,
San Francisco Design,
Park City Mountain,
and of course, listeners like you. We're always interested in your ideas and advice to help make this show what you want it to be. This is your show about environmental issues. Contact us. Email us at thisgreenearth@kpcw.org.
This is KPCW 91.7 FM Park City. We've got your Wasatch back.
Thanks again for joining us. Here is NPR News.